chances to enjoy the Vanguard Jazz Orchestra on October 10th. More information about upcoming events is at GranardCenter.com.
It's 2:40 in sports as Illinois prepares for its next game against a ranked opponent. Penn State's linebacker Sean Lee says his sprained left knee is feeling better, but he hasn't returned to the practice field. Lee says he's rehabbing every day and just started jogging again. It's up to the team doctor to tell whether Lee will be ready for Saturday afternoon's game with Illinois. The team captain was hurt September 19th in a win against Temple. Lee came out in uniform for Penn State's loss to Iowa wearing a black knee brace but never entered the game. Indiana coach Bill Lynch has told his players all season to leave the past behind. Now he has a chance to show them what he means. 3 days after he threw his headset and tossed a piece of chewing gum toward the seats at Michigan Stadium, Lynch reverted to his more laid-back form, joking about what may have been the biggest sideline outburst of his coaching career. Lynch says he doesn't think the gum hit anyone. He acknowledged the only thing he's thought about since Saturday's 36-33 loss to Michigan has been the Hoosiers' next challenge, number 9, Ohio State. The Miami Dolphins have made it official. Chad Pennington is out for the season. Pennington was placed on the injured reserve list to create a roster spot for quarterback Tyler Thigpen. He was acquired Tuesday from the Kansas City Chiefs for an undisclosed draft pick. Pennington likely faces a third operation on his right shoulder since 2005. He was hurt in last Sunday's loss to San Diego that left Miami at 0-3 on the season. In baseball, Orlando Cabrera got a go-ahead single in the 10th, and the Minnesota Twins pulled within one game of American League Central leading Detroit. They beat the Tigers 3-2 this afternoon in the opener of a day-night doubleheader. Tigers ace Justin Verlander was set to pitch against Brian Dunsing in the nightcap. In Chicago, the Cubs need one more victory to clinch a third straight winning season. They begin a series with the Pirates tonight. 10-game winner Ryan Dempster gets the start at Wrigley. Joel Piñeiro of the Cardinals looks for his 16th win of the season tonight in the opener of a series against the Cincinnati Reds. The Cards have an outside chance at capturing home field advantage in the playoffs. Their last six games are against teams with losing records. The White Sox try to extend their winning streak to 5 against the Indians as they continue their series tonight. Carlos Torres pitches for the Sox. And the Chicago Blackhawks have another preseason game in Switzerland today. They're playing Zurich ZSC. The St. Louis Blues, meanwhile, play a Swedish team, Linköping HC. And that's sports.
WILL programs are made possible with support from Lincoln Square in Urbana, a lifestyle center which includes the Great Impasta.
It's 2:43 on the Afternoon Magazine. U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan will soon be getting a new vehicle that should help protect them from perhaps their greatest threat, the roadside bomb. A key feature is its V-shaped body that deflects the blast from those improvised explosive devices, or IEDs. The vehicle is being built by Oshkosh Defense in Wisconsin, and the $2.3 billion contract from the Pentagon is creating hundreds of new jobs. Aaron Toner of member station WUWM in Milwaukee reports.
When you walk through the factory doors at Oshkosh Defense, the first thing you see are construction workers building a new assembly line. The company in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, is scrambling to increase production capacity to build 4,300 armored vehicles for the military, called MATVs. The MATV is a mine-resistant, ambush-protected vehicle that looks like a Humvee on steroids. It's 19 feet long, 98 inches wide, and weighs just under 25,000 pounds. Plant manager Jake Jones shows me around the sprawling factory and the different stations where workers are welding, installing, and inspecting.
So really on this line, we take the axles of a vehicle, we take the frames of a vehicle, and we actually build the durability and the muscle of a vehicle.
Jones says the MATV's durability comes from frame rails that protect the crew cab, a V-shaped armored hull that dissipates the force of a bomb blast, and thick armor plating on its body. Ken Juergens oversees a product line for Oshkosh Defense. He points out huge round coils inside the wheel wells that give the vehicle its agility.
What makes it unique is this is an independent suspension. So when you're going over heavy rocks and boulders and stuff like that, then the wheel moves up 16 inches both ways. So it rides fairly smooth for a military vehicle.
Marine Corps Brigadier General Michael Brogan says the design of the vehicle will impact the three major causes of IED casualties.
First of all, blast, if that blast wave gets inside the vehicle. Second is shrapnel or debris that is ejected from the blast. And then the third is acceleration. The vehicle is rapidly accelerated upward when an explosion occurs underneath it. And so having a very heavy vehicle with the V-shaped hull that sits high off the ground helps defeat all three of those blast mechanisms.
The M-ATVs will be integrated with older Humvees in Afghanistan that have been retrofitted with extra armor. Ken Juergens says the vehicle's construction can better handle the terrain in that country.
For Afghanistan, it's a whole new theater of operations. You're going where there's little roads, small villages, many mountains, harsh terrain, valleys, rocks. You had a whole bunch of things that you had to go off-road.
Juergens says right now workers are building 100 vehicles a month. Production will jump to 1,000 a month in December.
It's been a lot of hours, a lot of work. That's one of our competitive advantages. We are a military specialty truck manufacturer. This is what we do.
This summer, Oshkosh Defense hired 600 new workers for the M-ATV contract, and officials say more jobs could become available. A Pentagon official says the first shipment of inspected M-ATVs could be flown to Afghanistan as early as this week. For NPR News, I'm Aaron Toner in Milwaukee.
Playgrounds are supposed to be safe places for kids to play, but Tamara Keith of the Environment Report has the story of a leaked memo from the Environmental Protection Agency that indicates there might be a problem with crumb rubber.
Sean Clancy's two sons are having fun running around a community playset, and if they fall, he says there's plenty of crumb rubber. It's made from recycled tires and should stop them from breaking any bones.
I've seen kids fall from far distances. I've seen the give. I've seen them get right back up, and kids are playing with it. It's fun to dig in. They can kind of play with it. It's about 8 inches thick, so, you know, there's quite a bit of it.
Clancy and his neighbors like the fact that it lasts a long time and keeps old tires out of landfills. And they're not the only ones. I'm outside of the White House right now, just on the other side of the fence. And somewhere in there on those grounds, probably behind some tall shrubs, there is a playset. It's a new playset that Sasha and Malia, the first family, got. And underneath that playset is a pretty thick layer of rubber crumb to protect the girls if they fall.
I don't think anyone is suggesting that this exposure is good for kids. The only question is, how bad could it be?
Jeff Rook heads Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. His group got its hands on some documents where scientists at the Environmental Protection Agency question whether there's stuff in the crumb rubber that could be toxic to kids.
What's known is very, very little. They list, I think it's 30 toxic chemicals in one of the memos, and so far the only work has really been done on one or two of them.
An EPA spokesman says the agency is doing a preliminary study of four playgrounds looking for lead and volatile organic compounds. The results aren't in yet. The Rubber Manufacturers Association says there are more than 100 studies showing scrap tires are safe in playgrounds, and that environmental groups are overhyping the concerns. Richard Wiles isn't buying it. He's senior vice president of the Environmental Working Group, and he feels like he's seen this movie before with arsenic-treated wooden playground equipment.
It was a really bad idea to use arsenic in this way, and for about 20 years, that's what we did.
And kids all over the country were playing on this contaminated wood. But the thing is, initially arsenic-treated wood seemed like a great idea because it prevented decay and made play structures safe and strong for years. Parents might be left with the feeling that you just can't win. Wiles thinks there's another lesson.
We tend to use these products before we evaluate the health and safety concerns. We tend to just throw it out there without thinking that, oh, this is a surface that's made out of something that was previously considered hazardous waste.
With all the alarm about very real arsenic problems and yet-to-be-verified concerns with crumb rubber, Donna Thompson says it's easy to forget that playgrounds today are safer than they've ever been. She's executive director of the National Program for Playground Safety. For now, she's standing by crumb rubber because it does such a good job of preventing broken bones.
I'm not going to worry about it yet till I hear what the results are, because I think sometimes we make too big a deal out of something and then it's just not the case.
The EPA says it will have results in a few weeks. For the Environment Report, I'm Tamara Keith.
Support for the Environment Report comes from the Park Foundation, the George Gund Foundation, and the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation. You can find more information and share your thoughts at environmentreport.org.
A new environmental program is in the works in Florida. The government stimulus money is being used to grow coral and repair reefs. Government agencies and academic institutions are working together. It's the first time that coral reefs have been restored on this scale. NPR's Greg Allen tells us the story that begins with a man who makes his living selling tropical fish.
Ken Niedermeyer is tall and thin and has the look of a farmer. In fact, he is, sort of. Niedermeyer works in the water off the coast of the Florida Keys. And the crops he lovingly tends are actually tiny animals, coral. Niedermeyer makes his living selling tropical fish and what's called live rock. That's rock infused with algae, bacteria, and other microscopic organisms that's used in big saltwater aquariums. Several years ago, his daughter needed a 4-H project. Niedermeyer says he had some staghorn coral in his underwater nursery and an idea. Why don't we cut it, culture it, and sell it for use in aquariums?
We went out there and came up with a plan and went out there and did the first cutting and put them on the rocks. I learned a lot of lessons, and it was successful. We had 100% survival for the first year, and we thought, this is great.
Around that same time, though, Niedermeyer says, he became aware of how poorly staghorn and other coral species were doing in the waters off the Florida coast. They're under stress because of pollution and warming oceans. Numbers have declined dramatically. In Florida, coral reefs are a prized natural resource, crucial to divers, fishermen, and everyone here who depends on the tourist economy. Instead of selling his coral offspring, Niedermeyer approached officials at the Florida Marine Sanctuary with the idea of transplanting young coral to damaged reefs. They agreed, and he began perfecting his coral-raising technique. He says he takes small coral fragments, about as long as your pinky, and using special underwater epoxy, glues them to pieces of stone.
And that little 3-centimeter coral will turn into a branching coral that has 50 or 60 centimeters of growth on it after 1 year. So that one-year-old coral is then ready to be transplanted out.
Working with the Nature Conservancy and other groups, Niedermeyer has transplanted his staghorn coral to reefs throughout the Florida Keys. Now, with $3 million in stimulus money from the federal government, a consortium of research groups is expanding the project. On a sunny September Keys morning, researchers from the Nature Conservancy take their boat out to one of the new coral nurseries.
Jellyfish right below me.
Megan Johnson of the Nature Conservancy, wearing snorkel and fins, jumps into the water to check on one of the nurseries. It was started a little more than a year ago. We're about 4 miles off Big Pine Key in water that's nearly 30 feet deep. After diving for a closer look, Johnson returns to the boat.
There's about 200 coral fragments down there, and they were recently fragged about 2 months ago, so they're fairly small, about 3 centimeters, some of them, but then some of them are getting a lot bigger than that, so it's looking good.
With the federal stimulus money, Niedermeyer, the Nature Conservancy, and the other research groups are expanding these coral nurseries and adding 4 others, including 2 in the Virgin Islands. They hope to put 60 people to work raising and transplanting at least 12,000 corals over the next 3 years. Chris Berg with the Nature Conservancy says the project aims to do more than just some short-term repair work.
We'll never be able to grow enough coral to plant coral on every reef in Florida. It's too large of an area. It's too impractical. So the idea here is to create just enough coral that they can begin to breed on their own to jumpstart the recovery of the species.
On that score, there recently was some positive news. Last month, a team of researchers visited one of the reefs where Ken Niedermeyer transplanted corals. They were there at just the right time, one of the 2 or 3 nights each year when corals release their eggs and sperm into the water to reproduce. It was the first time researchers documented corals using sexual reproduction after being transplanted to a new area. Niedermeyer says by using selective breeding techniques, it may be possible not just to rebuild the coral population, but also to develop hardier varieties.
They can handle, elevated sea surface temperatures and bleaching and disease. And it's not just a holding pattern, it's developing that new strain. And you have to ask, do we want to have coral reefs? I do.
Florida is home to the world's 3rd largest coral reef, one that stretches more than 200 miles. Niedermeyer hopes breeding of hardier coral types may preserve it for future generations. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
College students who bought their textbooks over the last several weeks may be suffering from sticker shock. Now some universities offer a money-saving alternative. They rent textbooks. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, California, Marianne Rust reports on one school that's launched such a program.
college textbooks aren't getting any cheaper.
Did you find everything okay today?
Yeah, thank you.
These are for rent?
Okay, yeah, I can
just ask Kelly Carmichael. Oh, okay. She's a Sacramento State senior studying to be an elementary school teacher. She's paying for her books at the school's Hornet bookstore.
One book for one of my child development classes was $172.
When a professor mentioned that she didn't have to buy the book but could rent it this semester, Carmichael says it was a no-brainer.
So they had that for rent for, I think it was only $75, so it's so much better.
Carmichael's looking to save every cent she can right now.
I have a daughter, so I'm trying to spend as least money as possible. So,
just how much can students save? Hornet Bookstore Director Pam Parsons walks us through the store.
For any title that is for rent, you'll see a sign with it that will not only show the new and used price, but also the rented for price.
So for example, this text here, what's it called? Infants, Children, and Adolescents.
So new it would be $142, used it would be $106.50, and then you can rent it for $58.34.
Parsons says every rental book will be at least 55% off, but you do have to give it back at the end of the semester, and not every book can be rented. It's classes like Psych 101 and Anatomy, basic subjects that teach the fundamentals. For example, you won't find the latest computer text or a book about the human genome, because the store has to be able to rent the books for at least four semesters to make money on them.
So does renting mean no highlighting?
No, actually, highlighting is fine. What you don't want to do is dump it in a puddle and run it over or rip out the pages.
Sacramento State has 527 titles for rent. That's 15% of the store's total. According to the National Association of College Stores, only about 100 campus stores rent books across the country.
There's a couple of barriers.
Charles Schmidt is with the association.
One, it's very costly to start. Two, it's costly because you need extra warehouse space for the books. And three, you need to get the faculty on board.
Schmidt says it's not a new idea. He says rental programs have actually been around since the 1860s, but now they're growing at a faster pace. He says part of it may be the recession, but stores are also responding to competition from online book rental sites. That's something store director Pam Parsons is very aware of.
10 years ago, competition would be a store outside of your own store, and now competition is everywhere.
She says this semester, rentals have accounted for 10% of book sales so far. That's pretty significant, given that only 15% of the books can be rented.
That one is eligible as a rental as well.
Okay, and then I got one more book here for sociology, 8.
But renting isn't always the cheapest option. If a student buys a used book and sells it back, it's actually a few dollars cheaper. But that only works if the professor adopts that book again for the next semester. That's something junior Jose Villanueva says isn't worth the risk.
I still have books that I have from my freshman year, which was 3 years ago. I still can't get rid of them.
Sacramento State hopes to double its rental program within 2 years, and the federal government is stepping in